Doctor Show!
You have all made it through the dance. You have all made it.
Coming to you from the XXS, it's John of All Trades with your host, John X.
Welcome to the John of All Trades podcast, episode 87. I'm your host, John X. Thank you for joining us. Glad to have you back once again. This week's episode was someone I've known for quite some time, someone I've done some business with, someone who I think very fondly of, and that is Tim Wigley. He is the president of the Western Energy Alliance. And on this week's episode, we talk about oil and gas. Now, oil and gas, not as much in the news this year as it was in 2014, say, when there were a number of ballot measures that were proposed to limit oil and gas development, potentially curb it, potentially end it in this state. There are some ballot measures this year that are pertinent to oil and gas, but haven't been in the news as much recently. But I thought it a good time to sit down and talk with him about issues surrounding oil and gas, how he deals with activists, how he answers criticism, how he responds to people who maybe aren't so favorable to oil and gas. I mean, this is an important industry to our state and one that I have not touched on despite having a lot of professional experience in it. So I figured it was high time to do it. And I figured one of the best ways to do it would be to sit down with the president of one of the better trade associations out there. And that's Tim Wigley. Now, the Western Energy Alliance, as he says in this podcast, can be a little bit edgier. You think of a trade association, there are positions that they take that maybe are kind of predictable. But the Western Energy Alliance will take people to task that you may not expect. He talks about an interaction he had with New Belgium Brewing. He talks about dealing with the EPA or the U.S. Forest Service or U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. They're not afraid to take on those issues head on, and they're doing that in the interest of their clients. And I would argue that's an important role in a democratic society. Everyone has a voice. Everyone can say, hey, this is a bad decision, and this is why. And this is affecting real businesses. Tim talks about the membership of Western Energy Alliance, and a lot of his companies have between 6 and 12 employees. Now, that isn't exactly what you think of when you think of big oil, is it? Which is why this conversation is so valuable to me and why I was so pleased to have him on here. So we talk about fractivists. We talk about the role of fossil fuel in our lives. We talk about times when he's been shoved or spit on or basically harangued in public for defending the industries that he's defended. And he says from the time he was 6 years old on, he knew he wanted to be a lobbyist. So we get into that too. We get into his whole story. We talk about his band. His band is called Mud Puppy. They do really great work. You should find them on Facebook. I'll plug that at the end of the episode. One thing to note in this episode is that we taped it like 2 days before the Super Bowl. And Tim makes a couple of predictions there. One is that the Broncos will win the Super Bowl. And his prediction was right on, and that's awesome. It was so great. I'm recording this intro on the day that Peyton Manning announced his retirement. So he also goes on to predict who he thinks the Republican nominee for president will be. Now, I'm not going to spoil it, but it's not exactly in line with his prediction. So it's kind of funny. We taped this before Super Tuesday and actually I think before New Hampshire even. So I think you'll get some amusement out of hearing his predictions there. So just a couple of notes before we get started, something that you should know. A couple of quick plugs before we get to it. The first one, you always hear me plugging Facebook and Twitter. I've been on there for a long time. And you can find us at JOATpod. So facebook.com/JOATpod, twitter.com/JOATpod. You can also use that handle. So JOATpod, I just joined Snapchat. So find me on Snapchat. We can become friends there. I'm also on Pinterest. Follow me on Pinterest. Now, Pinterest is interesting to me because my wife's been on there for a long time, and we find really great stuff there. Stuff that's just a lot of fun, really cool, like ideas for our house, and then just funny stuff. There's this photo, and I think it'll be my first pin, of it's like these two girls with this dog. And I know that sounds dirty. It sounds like I'm setting up like a dirty joke. I'm not. It's just pure funny. So check me out on Pinterest. It's JOATpod. That's what you find across all the platforms. Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, Pinterest, all JOATpod. That's the only plug for the beginning of the episode because I want to get to it. This is episode 87. It's Tim Wigley. He's the president of the Western Energy Alliance. We have a great chat about oil and gas and a lot more. And that episode starts right now.
It's
It's a band called Mud Puppy, and it's a combination of a couple of us from Radio Flyer, much better band, playing much newer stuff, and it's actually fun again. For 3.5 years, I played with guys that I liked, but we just weren't going anywhere, and right. They weren't serious about it, and the talent level wasn't really all that great. And this band, the talent level, in fact, we're 5 songs into a 10-song demo now, and we'll start. All of us are old enough, and we've all played enough bars that we really don't want to do that scene. I mean, right. You go out and make $500 for killing yourself.
Right.
But the corporate side is where we like playing. So you play in private parties and corporate parties, and you play in a hotel ballroom. You're finished by 11 o'clock at night.
Right.
So
are you guys doing mostly covers or original stuff or what?
It's all covers.
Okay.
It's all based upon danceability. Every bar owner in this town, unless it's an original type bar, they want girls on the dance floor, because girls on the dance floor means there's guys behind them buying them drinks, right. And that makes bar owners happy. Bar owners don't care what you play as long as you got girls on the dance floor, because that means drinks are flowing. So.
What gets people out there?
You'd be surprised. It's old standard. It's Sweet Home Alabama, or anything from the Stones, or it's a variety of stuff. But you get requests from, do you know Brown Eyed Girl?
That was
me and my ex boyfriend or ex husband's favorite song, and you play it because you're getting paid to play what people want to hear,
sure.
Not what you want to play.
Right.
If you want to go play what you want to play, you'll be in those cheesy original bars where you're not making any money and nobody's there to see you except your two closest friends.
And a bunch of hipsters are tuning you out, right?
Yes.
A bunch of floppy beanie guys. If you could play, what would you play? If they're like, okay, this is Tim Wigley night. What would you want to hear and what would you want to play?
I'm a huge fan of Rush. I always have been.
As a drummer, of course.
Yes. I can't play anything like that. My favorite band of all time, the reason that I didn't start playing drums until I was 40, but in 1972, when I was 10 years old, I became a fan of the Eagles. And the mm-hmm. reason I always wanted to play drums is I wanted to be a lead singing drummer like Don Henley. And so a couple of weeks ago when Glenn Frey died.
I thought of you. You were the first person I thought of when I heard that.
You'd be amazed at how many calls I got from friends, not only around the country but here in Denver. And literally some of them said, are you okay? Do you want me to come sit with you? One person brought me over a bottle of Bacardi and Diet Coke. And I didn't believe it at first. I was on the internet and heard the news, saw it on a post. You know how sometimes there's fake posts, like Peyton Manning just went down in a plane crash or whatever?
Right.
And so I went and checked the real website of like Fox News or CNN or whatever, and sure enough. And I was devastated, because not just because of the loss of great talent, but the Eagles are done. I mean, that band is done. You can't beat the Eagles without one of those two. And so losing them forever, just because I raised my two kids on purpose. When my daughter was liking Justin Timberlake, NSYNC and all that, I kept telling her they won't be playing that 20 years from now, but they will be playing the Eagles 50 years from now. So.
Interesting. It's funny. I had Taylor Gonda on this podcast, who she's one of the co-hosts of These Things Matter. And she's a huge David Bowie fan,
mm-hmm.
massive David Bowie fan. And she was the first person I thought of. It's amazing how you can get associated with an artist and people almost mourn for you when they're also mourning the artist.
Well, in this new band I'm in, Mud Puppy, which has been together about 4 or 5 months, the talent is so good that the week that David Bowie died, we showed up that Saturday night for rehearsal and played 4 or 5 David Bowie songs that none of us had ever played before.
Nice.
But the guys are good enough to pull it off. And it was actually fun because, I grew up in that era as well. So it's just some giants. Earth, Wind, and Fire's founder died yesterday.
Yeah, I just read that.
Boy, the last 3 or 4 weeks have just been brutal.
Yeah, it sucks, man. I remember right before my daughter was born, the last Ramon died, the last original Ramon. My wife, we had this Ramones onesie for her. And she said, I'm sad that our daughter is going to grow up with no original Ramones alive.
Yeah.
I mean, Marky Ramone is still out there, and he hosts Punk Rock Blitzkrieg on Sirius XM, which I listen to, and it's great. And Marky Ramone sounds like Daryl Hammond doing Donald Trump.
Well, I love him, too. Playing the song Sedated is one of my favorite songs to play.
It's a great song,
too,
so. Yeah. But that's your moonlighting gig, right?
Yeah, it's fun on the side. When I was before I moved here, I was in a band in Washington, D.C. called Cover Up. And we played about 625 shows in about 5.5 years.
Jeez.
I never had a Friday, Saturday open. but it was fun because I traveled all week long. I'd come home on a Friday and run home, get my drums, and throw them in the truck and go. And my fiance Melissa, who she was very supportive of it, still is. But
right.
I left her home on a Friday and Saturday night many, many, many times.
Not so many date nights.
No, but she actually enjoyed it because our jobs are such that her hair's on fire, and she actually kind of liked the downtime. So.
Well, sure. So we're sitting here in your office here, and since you guys have moved here, this office is so much nicer than your previous one.
It is. Back when the oil boom was still booming and real estate prices and commercial real estate was going up like crazy, I received a call from my landlord over in our previous address that said, we're going to raise your rent 35% and we're going to make you move to a different floor. And I thought,
sweet,
if we're
going
to move, then we might as well move. And we came over here to the Denver Financial Center, and one of our generous members agreed to help us fund our first year. And you know, they gave us a nice construction fee to rearrange it the way we wanted. And so now we have fabulous space, and we have plenty of room to entertain lots of folks. We've had receptions in here of 100 people. We had 4 presidential candidates come in here earlier this year into the office to meet with 30, 40 of our members. And it's been a great space for us, worked out. And the views are, as you can see.
Oh, exceptional. I mean, I do a lot of these, many of them from my basement, and the view isn't nearly as good as what we have here. But Western Energy Alliance, been around for how long now?
1974. It used to be called the Independent Petroleum Association of the Mountain States,
right.
And IPAMS. And a couple of years before I arrived January 1st of 2012, and they changed the name to Western Energy Alliance. But we represent now about 300 oil and gas producers and service companies throughout the Rocky Mountain West, and we help them advocate on their behalf in Congress. We're a federal group, so you won't see us in state capitals, but we work very closely with groups like Colorado Oil and Gas Association, New Mexico Oil and Gas, Texas, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But I've got a small staff of 7 here. I've got one person over in Salt Lake City that covers Utah, and then I've got a person in Washington, D.C. that covers our federal lobbying efforts.
I mean, what types of things are you advocating for, and how do you differentiate yourself from all the various groups that are out there?
Well, we cared very deeply about, while we work on more than just federal land or public land issues, that's kind of what we're known for, our bailiwick across the country. And the Alliance is, I'll say, before I got here, and still is, very well respected in D.C. and throughout the country. We're kind of edgy. Where a lot of groups are afraid to call out federal agencies like the BLM and Forest Service and all that, we're not
EPA.
EPA. We're not afraid of that at all. And when they do something stupid, then we call it stupid. And I've got a person here that works for me, that Kathleen Sagama, who I consider to be one of the best federal land policy persons around the country. And so when there's a bill that comes up in Congress that's going to change taxation or royalty rates or enhanced regulations and so forth, if we think it's in the worst interest of our members, we go and oppose it. If we think it's a good thing for us, like the crude export bill that we worked on all year long in 2015, that's something that we actually lobbied for. There are 4 trade associations for the oil and gas within about a block and a half of each other here in Denver. But we work very closely with all of them. We all have our own lanes that we fill, and we coordinate carefully so that way, particularly in markets like this where you got $30 oil, our member companies expect there to be a high level of coordination, and there is.
Yeah, no, I mean, that makes perfect sense. So I'm curious, how do you have the license to sort of be edgy? Because I know that some groups are afraid to call out, as you said, stupid decisions when they're stupid. Is that sort of part of your value proposition? Or, I mean, I'm assuming it's intentional, but how has that come to be where you're regarded as sort of edgier than maybe some of the other trades?
Well, part of it comes from history, and this organization's always kind of been known for being a little tougher. When you work with companies, large, small, we represent mainly independents. Some of the larger independents are a little bit more concerned about our edginess at times if we're pushing the envelope too much. But that typical oil and gas company, our typical member has 12 employees.
Wow.
They don't have a lobbyist. They don't have a full-time attorney. And they really rely on a group like the Western Energy Alliance to do their work for them. And they demand and want a voice. And while it may make people uncomfortable when we go after the BLM or go after President Obama and some of his policies. If we don't do it, I don't know who is going to do it. If we don't call out and educate the public as to why this particular policy is bad for not only the consumer but bad for our member companies and so forth, I don't know who else will do it. And the good thing about having a trade association like us, if you're a corporate entity, is – we can be the bad guy without you having to be the bad guy. Your name doesn't have to appear in the newspaper. You don't have to be on Fox News being interviewed by Neil Cavuto or whoever it might be. We do that stuff. So my background is in politics and campaigns. And, right. and you know, while we need to be responsible and put forth good, accurate information and data, you need to be willing to throw in a punch. I've never won a fight ever without throwing at least one punch in the process.
Right. Sure. There are people with legitimate concerns about oil and gas activity, say, that goes on in and around them. And then there are those who are sort of bombastic. How does your approach differ in dealing with those two kinds of stakeholder groups?
I mentioned earlier that I've grown up in politics. This is my 36th year in politics. I started off running campaigns at all levels and then got into lobbying and got into ballot measures and so forth. I've had the privilege of working, starting off in the mining industry. And then I spent 15 years in the timber industry in the Pacific Northwest. I learned how to deal with radicals out there during post-Spotted Owl wars and so forth. Denver is very similar to Portland, except for the sunshine.
Right.
But very similar politically than Portland. And I was taught many years ago, and I'm a big fan, one of my political idols is LBJ. We don't necessarily share the same politics, but right. I loved his politics. And he used to use the term, don't get together a crowd for your opponent. And, okay. That's pretty prophetic. And so the really fringe groups out there that just go crazy and, you know, in timber, they would literally hang themselves off of trees and we'd bring members of Congress out to see a forest and they would set up there and throw things at them, bottles of urine and all. I mean,
at members of Congress?
At members of Congress. We don't quite have that kind of severity here, but recently on the fossil fuel, this group called Keep It in the Ground is a new campaign, and they don't want any fossil fuel development. And they're the ones that recently 1,000 kayaks and canoes sitting in Puget Sound protesting.
Oh yeah, I saw that. Development.
Of course, all those kayaks and canoes were made from fossil fuels. A few days later in Portland, they hung themselves off the St. John's Bridge with about 20 or 30 canoes literally dangling over the Columbia River. Again, all made of fossil fuels. And so what I try to do in this, I'm a firm believer that on the energy debate, if you work for the oil and gas industry or have family in it, naturally you're going to be very supportive of it. If you don't, you don't really care. And so we live in a society, though, that everybody lives on fossil fuels. I believe the industry has to have an attitude of teaching the public what's in it for me. And what's in it for me is your kids' school programs, whether they're in music or sports or whatever. What's in it for me is fire and police, you know, forces and so forth around the country.
You're talking about tax benefit from severance taxes and ad valorem taxes and things like that.
And I have no problem with people that want to push ballot measures, that want to ban energy development or ban fracking or whatever. It's our responsibility as an industry to educate them. Okay, that's fine. You have that right to have that position. But here's what's going to happen if that position were to become the rule of law.
Here's what's at stake, basically, is what you're –
what's in it for me. So we live in a society, again, Denver being very similar to Portland where I lived 10 years, where people don't really have a connection with the land because more and more generations now left the farm or left the rural communities to come to the city. And so we live in a society where people think 2x4s come from Home Depot or Lowe's.
Right.
Gas comes from the Shell station. Milk comes from King Soopers. And electricity comes from the wall. It just magically appears.
Right.
And I talk to groups all over the country that they don't think about stuff. That smartphone they have in their hand, it's just always been around in this generation. My daughter's 22, my 26, my son's 21. They've never not had these in their life. And so understanding that about 2 months ago, we issued a 5-day fossil fuel free challenge. And it came from one of my former bandmates in Washington, D.C., a guy who's worked in the federal government all of his life. He's 61 years old, drives a Prius, which is fine. Our keyboard player, good guy. And he's always posting on Facebook about how bad fossil fuels are, and he's always criticizing me for defending the fossil fuel industry.
Okay.
And I called him up one day and I said, Gordon, you know, I'm just curious. You think you could live 5 days without fossil fuels? And he said, of course I could. And I go, well, how would you go about doing something like that? And he says, well, I'd ride my bike to work every day. I said, well, no, you wouldn't. The tires, the lubricants, the seat, not to mention the metals were forged somewhere, probably by natural gas.
Probably.
He goes, okay, well, I'd just telecommute and work from home on my computer. I said, Gordon, I'd be interested to know what you plugged that iPad into, because it's also fossil fuels. And we went down the line all the way to, if you just wanted to sit home for a week, do nothing and drink beer. I said, no, you can't drink beer because it gets trucked to the cool bars in Lodo or Georgetown.
Right.
You know? So it quickly taught me that people in today's society, particularly in urban cities like Denver, which has a huge population that's growing from out of state, have no clue where their stuff comes from.
Well, it's interesting too. It's, you know, did you eat a banana today? If you did, I don't think we're growing many bananas here, period, but especially at this time of year.
Right.
I mean, how much of that comes up from, you know, places like Honduras, and how is it getting here?
Well, I recently had a conversation back in 2012 when the city of Longmont passed a fracking ban in the city limits. And a famous brewery up in Fort Collins, New Belgium, a brewery, who I love their beer, and I always have loved their beer.
Wonderful.
But their CEO came out in support of the frack ban, and I got her on the phone, and I invited her to our office at our other office, and just to ask a few questions. I assume in the manufacture of beer that there's a lot of rules and regulations that you have to adhere to, and that's great because it gives us the certainty that when we crack open a cold bottle of Fat Tire that we know it's safe to drink. That's a good thing. Regulations are good.
Right, yeah.
I give you the benefit of the doubt that you're doing your job, but why would you not give my industry the same benefit of a doubt? And then I asked the question, I'm even more curious, that fabulous beer that you produce that you send to all the cool bars in Lodo that I like to hang out in, how's it get there?
Right.
And she said, well, we truck it, of course. But you're against fracking. And that's the thing, is that people don't understand that something that they may feel strongly about, but their entire lives, every single minute of every single day, is based upon the use of fossil fuels. And do we really want to change our lifestyle for one of a third world nation? Because if you look around the world, the ones that have strong economies and strong health care and all that, they all are based on fossil fuels. Look around the world of those countries that don't, where people are dying of disease and sickness, they can't get clean water and all that. It's lack of access to fossil fuels.
You know, one of the most powerful scenes to me in Spoiled was when he showed the difference between the Dominican Republic and Haiti, which is on the same island.
Right.
But there's a border, and at one point, the Dominican Republic provided a subsidy for people to switch to natural gas cook stoves, whereas Haiti was still burning wood, largely, and Haiti was entirely denuded.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you saw it from above, and you saw where the border was, and that was a very powerful image to me, where I go, oh, okay, so if we're not doing natural gas, which is clean burning, we're doing something else, and what is that something else?
One of my favorite movies, Mark Mathis is a good friend of mine. In fact, he's coming out. He just released Fractured, which is the follow-up to that.
Oh, interesting. I hadn't heard about that.
Yeah, it's just out. I can get you a copy of it. I like Mark because he puts cool music in his movies. And, but he also tells a great story.
Right, right. You brought up something else. And one thing that I think gets confused in this debate is the idea that, and having worked in this industry for a long time, is people believe that the oil and gas industry is against regulation. You know, they say you guys are unregulated, you don't want to be regulated. I think that's entirely untrue, and it's a falsehood. And one of the things that I've found is people have legitimate concerns because they're undereducated about it. Mm-hmm. And when you talk to them, hey, you know what? This industry is not against regulation, but it's how can we instill the confidence of the public that those regulations are good. And I think that's a very real challenge.
John, you hit it on the head when the ballot measures first started to appear against oil and gas in Colorado in 2012 and 2013, we were very instrumental in forming a group called Coloradans for Responsible Energy Development. It's called CRED. And we started doing a series a lot, I think 27, 28 focus groups where we sit 20 women in a room at a time, and then for 2 hours, then 20 men for 2 hours. And they're literally hooked up to a little dial.
I'm sorry, how many of these focus groups?
I think 27 we're up to.
That's a lot of hours.
Because when you set the people that go to these groups, we screen them out. We don't want anybody who works in the industry. Mm-hmm. We don't want anybody from an environmental activist standpoint. You can't be straight Republican. You can't be straight Democrat. We truly want to get a cross-section. But when it comes to regulations, there's another movie called Frack Nation, which I'm sure you've seen. Mm-hmm. And there's a scene in that movie where a guy from an unnamed oil company was sitting at his desk, and he talks about the various layers of rules and regulations that every company has to go through,
right,
at every drill site, from air to water to native tribal lands to wildlife to this to that. And pretty soon the stack of regulations, and it's real, is so high you can't even see him behind his desk.
Right.
We turned off the TV and ask the people in the room, what do you think about that? And that typical answer is, well, we know that company, whoever he works for, is just going to write a check for $1 million and make that regulation go away. Nothing could be farther from the truth, particularly here, wow, in Colorado, which is known for having the most stringent rules and regulations governing oil and gas development of any state in the country. So I see that as our fault as an industry, yeah, that we haven't done a good job of letting people know what we do, how we do it, how we're regulated, and more importantly, how we're compliant with those regulations. And I blame that, again, 4 years ago when I was interviewing for this job, I told the selection committee, we got to do a better job in this industry letting people know what we do and how we do it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that belief is not only an indictment of the oil and gas industry, but of the government as well. It's a complete mistrust of almost the entire system, which, well, I mean, that's –
all the industries I've worked for that I've mentioned all have one thing in common: really smart guys and gals that are engineers and geologists. They are right, linear thinking, up and down thinkers. People who do what I do, advocacy and politics, think side by side. Mm. And it's not their fault. They're way smarter than I am, but they're not necessarily good communicators with the public at large. And so that's what I've hoped that I've brought to the alliance is knowing not only what the issues are, identifying the issues, who needs to hear about it, and who needs to talk about it. I may be good before a chamber of commerce talking about oil and gas,
right,
but if women that are 30 to 55 years old, regardless of party affiliation, and they're concerned about the health of their kids, well, we need to have the right type of people given the right kind of message with the right kind of messenger, and that's what we're trying to change as, right, far as the outreach from the industry here.
Yeah, that's at the nut of what you do. And one of the things that I'm also struck by is I think if people are concerned about oil and gas, there are some people who don't like that kind of dialogue because they've already made their mind up. They go, this is safe. You should think this is safe. Why are we even talking about this? I think that kind of dialogue is healthy because it engenders a better understanding of the entire system. And if you're asking those kinds of questions, it probably means you're going to ask questions about everything else, and I think we're all better for it.
I believe in seeing is believing. I'm a Southern Baptist kid from Oklahoma called a baptism. When I did timber out in the Pacific Northwest, and we faced ballot measures too. We faced a ballot measure to ban clear cutting, which is very important scientific way to manage forests in the Northwest.
And probably misunderstood.
It's totally misunderstood, and we had to finally boil it down to real simple messages that people could believe. When they found out that since the 1930s, every tree harvested has to be replanted within 1 year,
wow,
that's information they never knew. When they found out
I didn't know that.
Since the 1930s, you can't use herbicides and pesticides within a certain amount of feet from a fish-bearing river and stream, that's information they didn't know. When we went through this process here in Colorado over the last couple of years, getting prepared to fight ballot measures, and you sit in these focus groups with people and you give them information that's current law, it's the first time they had ever heard it. Again, that is the industry's fault.
Right, yeah.
I think it's our duty to let people know what it is we do and how we're regulated, and again, most importantly, how we're compliant. Because what I've seen in all industries is once people hear that and it gets reinforced, mm-hmm, then – they're never going to love us. My goal for Western Energy Alliance is not for everybody across the country to love big oil. My goal is for them to understand us to a greater degree and then get to the point where they're, okay, I'm all right with it because they're regulated, it seems, right, to be, and they become tolerant of us and allow us to coexist. That's my goal. I think that's the best the best an industry like Big Oil can get to.
What you're describing is kind of a benign indifference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When you get into these types of, call them fights, you said, you know, you've never been in a fight where you haven't had to throw a punch. Does the issue ever get confused, and do they start coming after you personally?
Oh, yes. Over the years.
And how do you handle that?
I've been in Mississippi at a public hearing. I've been spat on. I've been shoved and punched. And I mean, they're kind of crazy to pick on me because I'm a fairly big guy.
Right.
But, you know, you don't take the bait. Not all the environmental communities this way. But there are people on the fringe elements who want a fight. They want to cause a spectacle. Mm-hmm. They want someone like me to respond in a super negative way. And, you know,
you give them fodder then.
Right. And again, I go back to the saying, never get together a crowd for your opponent. I teach our folks, look, I think we have the moral high ground. We provide stuff that makes your life better and easier. Mm. And so don't get down in the dirt and the sewer with these people. Talk about what it is we do with a smile on our face. The whole reason for the fossil fuel challenge was to have some fun with it.
Right.
And to say, you guys don't like fossil fuels, you hate the big oil, then live without it. Take the challenge for 5 days and let me know how it goes. Right. And we knew exactly what the response would be. And some of the more radical groups called us, you know, petty and petulant and stupid and this and that. Well, that's fine. But my goal is to make the average person that you see on the mall think about this stuff for a while and go, wow, I'm not sure I want to give up my lifestyle and my car and my bike and my boat and so forth. And that's our responsibility as an industry. And we're getting better at it, but it's taken a long time.
Does it ever wear you down, though, like personally?
You know, no, and because I'm weird, I tell everybody, I start off every speech. I give about 75 speeches a year all across the country. And every one of them I start off by saying, I must warn you, I'm a demented child from Oklahoma City. And they laugh, and I go, the reason I say demented is my dad owned a chain of supermarkets in Oklahoma. He was very active in the Oklahoma Grocers Association. He was chairman in the National Grocers Association. And I grew up as a young kid watching him testify on Capitol Hill in D.C. as well as back in Oklahoma City in the state capitol. And I decided at age 6, 1968, when my buddies were knocking on the door saying, Wigley, come on out, let's shoot some hoops. I was busy watching the Democrat National Convention and Hubert Humphrey's acceptance speech. I knew when you had dress-up days in school and you'd go as a fireman or a policeman or a nurse or whatever, I'd come in a suit and tie with my hair greased back with a briefcase, and the teacher would say, Tim, what are you, a Wall Street banker or a lawyer? And I go, no, I'm a lobbyist. And not many 6 or 7 year old kids know that, but that's all I've ever wanted to do. And so very active in student politics. And then I ran my first campaign for state senate in Oklahoma when I was 17, a senior in high school. And
jeez.
And then I've never stopped. And so it takes a special kind of cut of a person to want to do this.
Right.
And that fundamental cut is, do you like to fight? I don't mean physically. I mean, do you like engaged? I probably should have gone to law school. I didn't do it because I wanted to do campaign work. But you got to really like the fight.
Do you like that spirited sort of back and forth? And
oh,
that, yeah.
This time of year, you ask anybody who knows me, you know, while I love Christmas, I love Thanksgiving, all that, I love election night most of all. I tell my employees here and every place I've ever worked, election day, I will be totally worthless as far as productivity in the job. I'll pace back and forth. I am anticipating. I've got my computers friends all across the country who are in the same business. What's turnout like in Ohio 3 or whatever?
Right.
It's just a passion for mine. And so last night watching the Democrat debate and watching the town hall the night before and watching Iowa results on Monday, I mean, I was glued, fixated to the – in fact, I was meeting with one of our members this morning – planning our Super Tuesday night up here and election night up here, where I gather some friends and we put grease boards all over the place and we target races all across the country we've been following. And
wow,
I don't go to bed election night till 2, 3, 4 in the morning. So,
well, the next day's a Wednesday. Good God.
I know, but it's just a cross I bear that I've borne for, again, this is my 36th year in politics in some way, shape or form. I'm not that old either, but I started early.
Yeah. No, that's intense. And if you're friends with you on Facebook, as I am, if you're not politically inclined, I imagine you get muted quite a bit. Because it's a fairly constant stream of political stuff.
It is. Right now, we're kind of in a silly season. I mean, I love people. modems like that of Facebook. It's a great invention. And it's fun during election cycles. It's fun during Super Bowl week. You follow me. I talk politics, oil and gas politics. I talk Oklahoma City Thunder basketball,
right.
OU Sooner football,
yep.
And band. That's pretty much all I talk about. But this crowded field on the Republican side, it's just weird watching people that are supposedly in the same party just kick the living heck out of each other on Facebook. And I'm almost to the point, and it's barely February, where I'm kind of tired of it.
So. Really?
Yeah, the level of discourse and just the type of discourse in watching this Republican presidential primary, it reminds me of seventh grade in the lunchroom. You know, guys, you can't sit here, or you slide a sandwich underneath you before you sit down. I mean, it's just dumb, silly stuff. And these are really smart, quality people, but they've stepped down to seventh grade level.
You know, I'm curious about your take, since you've been in politics for so long, about primaries, because I'm finding primaries to be a mixed blessing, and it seems to be the death knell for the moderate. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, you look around the country, particularly in light of the advent of the Tea Party a few years ago. Mm-hmm. I mean, they've done some wonderful stuff. They clearly impacted the 2010 federal elections. They clearly impacted the 2014 federal elections. I mean, the reason the Republicans have gained majorities is in large part due to people coming to the polls that had not been active. But these primaries are becoming so nasty, and we're almost issuing a purity test.
Yeah.
Ronald Reagan used to say, you know, we're 85% friends, not 15% enemies. And I think we've gotten away from that all too often. And so if a person that has a 90% voting record on conservative causes or liberal causes happens to step off the ship for a particular vote, we scold them, we scorn them, we embarrass them. And that's just a silly way to – no one gets everything they want in life.
No, I think about this. The 85% friends thing is really illustrative to me, because I think about your friend who you play in a band with, who is always busting your chops about defending the oil and gas industry. At the end of the day, you guys are still friends, right?
Oh, yeah. We absolutely are. And you know, it's just one of those things that for some reason – and I'm not going to blame this on President Obama – but I actually go back to the election of George W. Bush in 2000. I had the privilege of being down there for 17 days in Florida, being one of the vote counters.
Wow.
It was an amazing experience to go through. But I really believe the serious divisiveness and polarization of politics stems from that. Mm. Whether you believe he won or not, I mean, he won 6 or 7 recounts and all that, but there's half the population in this country thinks that his daddy's Supreme Court gave him the election.
Right.
And if you follow it, except for 9/11, when everybody kind of reunited, if you follow it from 2000, when he won that campaign, or maybe didn't win it, it's just been crazy, the polarization. And I've never seen Congress more divided than it is, and people that you're close to, I think, would probably say the same thing. It's just everything is a partisan vote. It's silly for us to be that way.
I couldn't agree more. To me, that is not reflective of real life.
All right.
Because I think about the work that you do in oil and gas. You have to get along with regulators. You have to get along with your neighbors. You have to get along with your fellow companies. You have to talk with activists. You have to bring everyone to the table. And to whatever extent you're going to agree, that's fine. But it's not so black and white as it seems to have gotten in Congress, which is frustrating to watch.
Yeah, I met this morning with a Democrat candidate for the state legislature here in Colorado who's a pro oil and gas guy. And, you know, he believes that it adds benefit to our state's overall, you know, way of life and so forth. But concerned that he'll get ostracized and scorned in his own party, there are people in the Republican Party, the federal and state level, who have moderate beliefs about things like oil and gas development or just development in general.
I look at Perlmutter's vote on the export.
Right. Yeah. And you know, it's sad that it's become so party line, and it all goes to control. Who controls a particular chamber? And so every vote is based upon, is this going to hurt our chances of maintaining control? I've never really been – it's a different topic, but it's related – never been a huge fan of term limits. I've lived through them in a couple of states that I've lobbied in. At the federal level, the congressional level, I totally think that our founding fathers never intended for somebody to go to the U.S. Senate and spend 45 years there. I don't think that was their intent. And it's become so entrenched. You got too many people who are only worried about the next November. Right. That's not the way to do policy.
Well, no. And basically keeping your eye on keeping your party in power is such a craven way of doing your job. It's like we're trying to have a country here, for God's sakes.
It's just I don't want to say it's a complete mess and it can't be turned around, but some hearts and minds are going to have to change. And I think what you're seeing in 2016 and all of 2015 is there's anger out there, and I've never seen it the way it is right now. And people are to the point where they're ready to throw every one of them out.
Right.
If I were any incumbent, no matter what party, no matter what state, I'd be nervous if I was running in 2016 because there's something out there. And, you know, Mr. Trump has tapped into that. Whether he's going to ultimately be the Republican nominee, I don't know.
Right.
But he's tapped into it, and people better pay attention.
I would say Senator Cruz has tapped into that as well.
Absolutely.
Senator Sanders.
Right.
On both sides. You know, you've got outsiders coming in. Promising to, you know, they look like cowboys.
Well, having been an insider in D.C., I lived there for 6 years, but I've been working there for a better part of 20. And there are certain consultants that always get the contracts. There are certain lobbying firms that always get the contracts. And it becomes a very incestuous process back there on both sides of the aisle, on both parties. And that's why you're seeing so much angst amongst – you keep hearing the term establishment on every newscast. The establishment is that crowd. It's the crowd that always gets the contracts. It's making a lot of money off of government and so forth. And they're scared. They're scared to death that all of a sudden that contract may not be there and someone – a new president that doesn't come from politics might come in and shake the whole thing up. And so you're really seeing a clash of wills there of people trying to
self-promote.
Self-promote and just to preserve themselves as well.
Acting in intense self-interest.
Right.
Yeah. Stepping away from the political side into a slightly different side, being the head of a trade association, this is one of the things I wanted to talk to you about. You not only are navigating everything externally, where you have a change in regimes, you're dealing with new legislators, people coming in all the time, a news media that I would say is turning over at an alarming rate.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition to that, you have how many members here at the Western Energy Alliance?
It's just over 300 right now.
300 members. Probably not always agreement internally in terms of what our priorities are, what we should do, how we should respond to various issues. What is it like navigating the internal politics of Western Energy Alliance?
It can be challenging, and one of the greatest challenges is the differing size of your various member companies. You got some companies that are members of ours that got 10, 12, 15,000 employees,
right?
Who have a team of lawyers and a team of lobbyists and so forth. As I said, you've got companies here that have 5, 6, 10, 12 employees who don't have that representation. And there are issues that come up that, quite frankly, on a regulatory side of things, that a large company could absorb that regulation, that new reg. They got the money and the people to be able to figure it out, where the little guy doesn't. Those things don't come up all that often, but when they do, it's pretty dicey navigation because you want to try to keep everybody on the same page moving forward at the same time. But there are times when there are clashes where certain companies are willing to agree to something where the others aren't. And that becomes quite an art to be able to navigate that. We don't typically have very many controversial issues like that. But when they come up, I'm just a firm believer and you put people in a room and you hash it out.
Yeah.
And you let people speak their mind and you always run the risk of somebody saying, we're going to take our ball and go someplace else. And it happens from time to time. But for the most part, the oil and gas industry is made up of, I think you'd agree with this, it's really good people who work in this industry.
It's generally salt of the earth people.
Right. They're hardworking. They keep their heads down. They're not braggadocious. They don't talk about themselves. They all want to, you know, better their company and better their own lives and all that. So it's generally not a problem, but it can be challenging.
Yeah, I can imagine, especially, I mean, with that many voices. Do you ever find when those things happen, are you almost like the child of divorce?
that's a very good way to put it.
Where you have mom over here wanting something and dad wanting something else, and you go, what do I do here?
I think the most important art I learned as a young guy working for the Mississippi Manufacturers Association, I was the head of government affairs, and I was a young guy. I mean, I was 25, 26, 27 years old. And my boss, the president, a guy named Jerry McBride, taught me early on that when you know you have a controversial issue brewing, don't wait until the board meeting to do your lobbying. The internal lobbying in a trade group is more important, I've learned, than the external lobbying to members of Congress or to members of the legislature.
Interesting.
So always do your lobbying way in advance. Know how to count noses. Anybody who's worked in politics for very long understands that one of the best skills you can have is know the rules and know how to count noses. And so I try to avoid having those meltdowns in the boardroom because myself and my staff have gone out prior to that meeting and make sure you've touched all the right people and know where they are, so that way you can try to avoid and alleviate that.
Is that sort of like, have you ever read The Art of War?
Oh, I went to a school, a campaign graduate school, where it was required that we read The Art of War once a year for the rest of our lives. and that was in 1986, and I read that book every year since then.
Gotcha. So yeah, every battle is won.
Always make your
fun.
Opponent wonder what you're going to do. And that's one of the things. I'm convinced Donald Trump reads The Art of War every single year because, you know, he'll say Ted Cruz stinks and smells like, you know, dog manure one day, and the next day he's saying, Ted Cruz is a really nice guy. I really like him. Yeah. It's the art of war. Always keep your opponents on their heels and second guessing.
And speaking about Donald Trump, which I don't want to spend a lot of time doing.
Nor do I.
I wonder if he has the best interests of the country at heart.
I don't know. I mean, I can't get inside of his head.
And I don't want to discern motives either, but I think about it and I go, This seems designed to embolden Donald Trump and very few others.
We live in a weird society that has changed a lot in my 53 years on this planet. We live in a country now where half the people don't pay any federal income tax. After they get their refunds or their various child credits or whatever, they effectively pay no income tax. And when you get in a situation where you have, if it gets up to 55, 56, 57%, imagine the dynamics of people who become an entitled society. We've seen it happen in Europe over and over and over again, and we've seen the results of what happens from that. There are people clearly in need. There are people that need help. But we live in a society where demographics are changing. I grew up in a very conservative Southern Baptist home in Oklahoma. The issues that are now common with my kids that are in college that are totally accepting of things that were not accepted when I was a child. And it's hard for my parents' generation who are still alive to accept that. They think the world's going to hell in a handbasket and so forth. And it's just it's an evolving society. And it's, you know, a lot of it's changed with, I think more than anything else, is technology. As a young lobbyist, when I would be up in the gallery watching a vote, I'd run down the hallway to a bank of payphones and call my boss and say, the vote just passed or whatever. Nowadays, you go into a gallery and everybody's, you know, instantaneous information. Yeah, yeah. When a candidate got in trouble on the campaign trail and did something stupid or got a DUI, it's instantaneous.
Yeah.
And so managing that information flow is challenging. And so, you know, used to in Congress, you know, when I first started, you could take a member out for a hamburger and a beer and talk to him about you're not going to buy a U.S. senator buying him a hamburger and a beer,
right.
But you had the ability to do that. Now, when you go into a restaurant with a member of Congress, A, you're not going to pay anything.
Yeah.
You spend the entire time looking over your shoulders, seeing if anybody's trying to snap a picture of you.
Oh, geez.
And it's really taken away the interpersonal relations that elected officials and constituents and or lobbyists have. It's become very non-personal now.
Well, you know, in the very second episode of this show, the second one that ever aired was with a lobbyist at the Colorado State House. And she said one of the unintended consequences of both term limits and Amendment 41, I think it is, the ban on lobbying gifts, was lobbyists used to pay for parties and people from both Democrat and Republican would go and socialize. And if you know someone on that level, you're less likely – I mean, they become a real person. Mm-hmm. And you're less likely to, you know, shoot the ad hominems at them.
Right.
And she said that made politics much more impersonal. The other thing it did with term limits was it gave all the institutional knowledge to the lobbyists.
Absolutely. That's absolutely true. When we first enacted term limits in Oregon while I was lobbying there heading up the Timber Association – We had a new speaker of the house because we met every 2 years, biennial sessions. We had a new speaker every single session.
Jeez.
And so, I mean, anybody who spends any time, I don't care if it's city hall or the county courthouse or whatever, it takes a couple of years to learn where all the bathrooms are, much less to learn about the rules and the process and the governing and all that. While term limits at the federal level I support, I don't support it at the state level just because those are people who are supposed to be the closest to their constituents.
Right.
I mean, when you go spend time in the Colorado legislature or any legislature, you'll see guys and gals there that literally, when they don't have the suit on, they're wearing overalls because they work on a farm or they work in a field. They're not always highly sophisticated people, but to have that constant turnover where nobody has a chance to become effective because it's really hard to come in as a freshman at any level of government and to set the world on fire because you just don't, you don't know how to do it yet.
Well, yeah, and you know, you come in with your issue. It's like, we want to change this. And it previously you could have a long-term, you know, long-term sort of senator or representative say, we tried that 10 years ago. Like right. that, I don't think it'll work now. It didn't work then. It's not going to work now. Right. Now a lobbyist has to tell them that, which seems like a perversion of the system.
That's what people truly don't understand is as good as term limits sound, it is definitely empowering to lobbyists. It gives them way more influence than they would have otherwise had. When I was a young guy in politics and you're dealing with a 75-year-old chairman of the Appropriations Committee who's been serving for 35 years, whether you like that or not, I couldn't pull anything over his eyes because he said, Sonny, you know, I've done that 3 times. It doesn't work.
And yeah, your game better be tight, right?
Right. That's for sure. That's for absolutely sure.
Wow. So, okay. Let's do a little pie in the sky here. How do we become a less contentious legislature at the federal level? What, in your estimation, how do we get to a place where we can actually work together and not always just at the agenda of our own party and our own self-interest?
It's a good question. I think about it all the time. And I think, you know, just because we've done something for 226 years or however long it's been, does it make it perfect? No. It's going to take some real statesmanship. And I've also thought about, should we maybe change up the rules and change up the Constitution? Think about this for a second. If you could only serve one term as president, but it was a 6-year term versus a 4-year term, you're not worrying about running for reelection.
Yeah.
That takes a lot off the table there. If you had term limits at the federal level and you could literally go in there and say, you know, I've only got 2 terms left, 4 years or 1 term left in the Senate, 6 years. Would it create more statesmanship where people would say, you know, guys, we got to do something. We know if we take this action, it's going to help create jobs.
Right
now, we don't take that action because of the partisanship divide and all that. I think the country is dying for somebody who's brutally honest. And I've been saying this for years that I'm 53 years old, as I've said. I've never expected to get Social Security. I'm right on the line with baby boomers. I'm barely in the baby boomer generation. And nobody that's on Social Security wants to give it up. But I tell my parents all the time, they're both 82. When you paid Social Security, you were at a super low rate. I've paid 7.5% plus my employer's match my entire career.
Right.
If I'm not going to get the money, why should I have to pay the money?
Yeah.
And I've said, I don't think it's not this year, but either in 2020 or 2024, somebody's going to run for president on that issue. Hmm. And their platform is going to be, if people that are 45 years old now are not going to get the Social Security money when they retire, then why the hell should they be paying it out of their paychecks?
Hmm.
And I contend that person will ultimately win. Because this generation now that's young, that thinks, oh, everybody's entitled, everybody's generous until it starts costing you money out of your pocket.
Huh.
All of us are basically at our core a little bit selfish. I don't mean selfish like I don't want you to have any food. I just mean that, you know, we want to protect what it is we earn. We want to protect our house and protect our valuables and so forth. I'm hoping that somebody's going to step up, maybe not this cycle, but soon when things get bad enough, and become that person that everybody rallies to and says, you know, he's right. This is not a partisan thing. Our country's going to go down the tubes if we don't solve this mess that we have called politics.
Projecting a little bit, if you care to do it, it's February 5th as we sit here right now recording this. I'm not exactly sure when this is going to air, but it'll be soon. As we sit here on February 5th, who's going to be the Republican nominee?
My gut tells me Marco Rubio.
Okay.
We've had four candidates up in our office earlier this year or last year when the race was just starting. We didn't pick them. They asked us if they could come meet with oil and gas people. One of them is Jeb Bush. One of them was Lindsey Graham. One of them was Marco Rubio. One of them is Ted Cruz. We invited all of them from both parties. Yeah. Rubio is very scripted, but you think about Marco Rubio sitting on a stage either against Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders or Joe Biden or whoever they're a bunch of old, you know, way back candidates on the Democrat side. A 43, 44-year-old Cuban who's well-spoken, who speaks articulate Spanish, who's pretty mainstream, conservative on the right issues. He's definitely pro-energy. As this race continues to thin out and people are dropping off every day, you'll have more drop-off after Tuesday in New Hampshire and even more drop-off after South Carolina. When Donald Trump's on a stage with only two or three other guys, I think he's going to get exposed. Hmm. And as much as I sometimes love him from the entertainment factor, saying the words, "I'm going to make America great again," is not going to fly at some point in time in these debates. Right. It's not going to be enough to satisfy the average voter.
Yeah, there's not enough meat there.
Right. And he's ran a masterful campaign so far, but I still say he's going to be exposed over the next two or three weeks. And at that point in time, I think the base of the Republican Party is going to say, you know what, it's more important to win than be right.
Right.
And so that's my prediction. And Hillary, short of getting indicted, I think she'll be the nominee from the Democrat side.
Okay. You think it'll be – so overall, Marco versus Hillary?
I think so. That's what my gut tells me.
Sure. Yeah, and we're just having fun here. I'm not holding
you to that.
Where does the Western Energy Alliance go from here? Because I know it's been interesting to be a part of this organization under the Bush regime and now under the Obama regime. It's two very different approaches to oil and gas management on federal lands. Where do we go from here, and does the price of oil rebound anytime soon? I know you're not a prognosticator in that regard, but how do you see it unfolding?
It's been a real experience for me. I've been through downturns like this in different industries, but this is my first time to go through a downturn in this industry. My first three budgets that I proposed for our board of directors were based at $105, $110 oil.
Right.
This budget that I proposed to our board last November was at $40 a barrel oil. And now that may seem high. You know, we've been forced to make some pretty drastic cuts. There's layoffs going on all across the country. And almost every day I get a phone call from one of our member companies saying, "Just want to let you know, next week we're going to lay off 10 people or 1,000 people." It always comes back. I mean, I grew up in Oklahoma where we've always been a boom and bust state. So I've seen this as an outside observer. But most people think that I trust that by the end of 2016, it will be in a more manageable range, say $50 to $55 a barrel. And that would be tremendously helpful. We kind of drew a line in the sand heading into 2016 that we're going to be playing pretty much all defense. There's just no resources out there for trade groups to do a lot of advocating and TV advertising and all that. And the Obama administration is going to continue to be very, very aggressive. When you speak to Obama officials at Interior, at Fish and Wildlife, at EPA, whatever, they use one word all the time: legacy. Hmm. They care very deeply about this guy's environmental legacy. So they're going to keep doing what I call stupid things, like yesterday announcing they want a $10 surcharge on every barrel of oil to fund green technology. I mean, what a slap in the face to this industry.
Wow.
An industry that totally pulled this economy out of a recession when we were the only ones adding jobs across the country.
You're talking about 2008, 2009?
Right.
Right.
So it's going to be a very defensive posture between now and January 20th of 2017. We will go through a process starting early this summer, as we do every 4 years, where we sit down with people that are political, that are regulatory, that do government affairs, people who have served in previous administrations, regardless of party, and we'll sit down and identify, you know, what 10 issues do we want out of a new president to address? And then we'll sit down and say, who do we know that might want to go back to D.C. and serve either again or serve for the first time in one of these various organizations like BLM or whatever? So that way we have a game plan ready to go prior to election. and we're able to hand the what I call the three-ring binder over and say, if you win on November 5th or whatever day it is, these are the kind of things we'd really like you to consider addressing. So that way we've got a game plan starting off. Because as you know, as you witnessed, the window to actually do stuff in a four-year term is really basically the first year.
Yeah,
because you get into the second year, Congress is running again. You got 33 senators running again, so nothing gets done. So you've got a one-year window in 2017 to try to address some of this stuff. And so we try to get ready for it.
And that's really too bad, too.
It is.
I mean, it's the way it goes, though. Okay, I'm going to ask you for one more prediction. This is February 5th. Super Bowl's on February 7th. Who wins the Super Bowl?
You know, anybody that – and I'm a former football player. I played in college, and I love it.
What was your position?
Nose tackle.
Nose tackle. That fits. As you tell me that, that just makes sense.
Yeah, I loved it. And I've been a lifelong Dallas Cowboy fan because when you grow up in Oklahoma, 85% Cowboy fans, 15% Bronco fans. And I've always liked the Broncos. I'm old enough to – I went to Dallas Cowboy games when they played in the Cotton Bowl.
Oh, wow.
I went to Dallas Cowboy games. I was there with the first year they opened up Texas Stadium. I was there the day they destroyed Texas Stadium. I've been to the new stadium. But when I moved to Denver and we started advertising with the Broncos and got to know some of the players and got to know some of the management, and of course Peyton Manning – living in Mississippi for 6 years, you know, he's a god.
Oh, sure.
And I was here at a great time, and the Cowboys were doing stupid stuff, and they had, what, 3 or 4 years in a row where they finished 8-8, and I officially on Facebook divorced them 4 years ago. And I threw away all my stuff, and my friends thought I was insane. And so I am a dye-in-the-wool Bronco fan now. A lot of prognosticators will say Carolina's stronger, faster, bigger, whatever. There's something about – I think back to John Elway's last game, and there's something about that that makes me think that our defense is so strong. If we keep this game close, you know, if it's a 17-17 game going into the fourth quarter, I totally can see the Broncos pulling this thing out. So you asked for a prediction. I'm going to predict Broncos 27-23.
That sounds good. I mean, I'll take it.
I'll take anything. I'll take 2-0. I don't care what it is.
2-0.
I really want Peyton Manning to you know, people think he's going to leave or not. But what a grand story for – it's not just him. It's the family. 30-for-30 series on ESPN, The Book of Manning. Right. I encourage everybody to see that because you see why he is the way he is because of his mom and dad. And all three boys are the same way. They're just decent people. And in this day and age of – stardom and glitz and bling and all that. I mean, these guys, you saw what Cam Newton wore off the plane the other day. If you saw the picture on Facebook, these crazy wild pants and all that. And Peyton is in a business suit. Looks like he can come into my boardroom and give a presentation. There's something about that that shows me the respect for the game and the approach that the Broncos have to the game. And that goes directly from Pat Bowlen and John Elway. That's why I like this franchise so much, is because they respect and they appreciate what they have and the fan base they have in this town. So I'll love them if they lose, but I'll love them a lot more if they win.
Yeah, 100%. This is the part in the show where you can plug anything you want. So where can we find you? Where can we find more about Western Energy Alliance, your band, your music, anything you want to plug? Please do it now.
Well, I'm on Facebook by the name Tim Wigley, and I love getting new Facebook friends. If people hear this and want to become a friend and talk, I'm there. WesternEnergyAlliance.org is our website, and there's a lot of good stuff about the oil and gas industry in there, including links to the Fossil Fuel Free Challenge. You can kind of see what we're doing there. My band, we don't have a website yet, but we are on Facebook. It's called Mud Puppy, and it's a group of four old guys, really experienced guys that enjoy playing. We just posted literally in the last 36 hours a couple of cuts from our demo disc, and we'll keep posting them over the next few weeks. And we'll eventually be putting up – we will be playing some public shows and some bars, and those will be posted right there on Mud Puppy. So we'd love for people to come out and hear us play sometime, and I think you'll enjoy it, and we're a bunch of fun guys.
All right. Fantastic, Tim. This was enormously insightful, getting to tap into your political experience and insights about the oil and gas industry. I just enjoyed it immensely. So continued success to you.
Thanks for having me. This was fun.
And go Broncos.
All right.
And that'll do it for episode 87 of the John of All Trades podcast. Thank you to Tim Wigley and the Western Energy Alliance for sitting down with me and talking oil and gas, talking about activism, talking about how you run a trade association. I mean, a trade association, every industry has one. And they all probably run a little bit different. It's nice to have insight how you navigate external politics, how you navigate internal politics. So, just hugely informative. He's a great guy, passionate guy. Check out Western Energy Alliance on the web. They are westernenergyalliance.org. And check out his band. He and his former band played one of Western Energy Alliance's, like, retreats, and they're a lot of fun. They have a lot of talent, and he says this new band is even better. So check out Mud Puppy. They're on Facebook. I link to that in the blog piece. It's on johnofalltrades.us, so johnofalltrades.us. Download the shows on iTunes or Stitcher, two great platforms for listening to the John of All Trades podcast. Official episode previews are only on Facebook. Those appear on Mondays. So check it out. We're off next week, but we'll be back in 2 weeks with a great episode. Find out who it is. Go to facebook.com/JOATpod. And a big thanks to our sponsor, 4Degrees, the number 4DEGREES. Your one-stop shop for all your online campaign needs, whether you're doing social media marketing, online advertising, whatever it is you need to do, 4Degrees will do it and do it more effectively and more efficiently than you've been doing it before. So the number 4DEGREES. We'll see you in 2 weeks. I'm off to spring training. So until then, say goodnight, Gracie.
That's good, Johnny.